clerk will call the docket. You may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice and members of the court. My name is Philip Leeser. I represent the appellant, George Premup, and I would ask to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
The issue in this appeal is whether the trial court erred in dismissing Mr. Premup's case with prejudice, and the assignment of error that this court granted is whether a dismissal without prejudice or alternatively a brief stay in the proceedings for at least 60 days would have been appropriate. The short answer is that the trial court had two available options to it. One was to simply overrule the plea and bar and allow the litigation to proceed uninterrupted. Or alternatively, in the exercise of the court's inherent supervisory powers over the proceedings, it could have stayed the proceedings for 60 days or a little longer to allow the parties to engage in non-binding mediation, not because they were bound by that provision in the contract, but in deference to the notion that the parties at least at some point had agreed that non-binding mediation would serve their interests.
Mr. Leeser, one of the things I think you probably ought to address is, I can't speak for my colleagues here, but I, for one, actually agree with what you just said. A better way to handle it would have been that way, as you suggested it. The question, it seems to me, was the judge wrong in handling it the way the judge handled it? So that's really the focus of this case. Not do you have a better way to do it, which you might have a better way, but I don't think that's the question.
Sure. I don't think it's a question of a better way. I think those were the only two legitimate options. A dismissal, whether with prejudice or without prejudice, was completely inappropriate.
Well, perhaps, but I guess what I'm trying to do is to focus the question a little differently. When a case comes up before this court, it has what's called an assignment of error. And you're retrospectively looking at the trial court, you're saying the trial court erred.
Correct.
So tell us how the trial court erred, even if I would have done it differently.
Okay, I will do that. Well, the first error was in its finding of fact that Mr. Premup had not abided by the terms of the mediation provision, which presumably required that at least 60 days before filing suit, he was required to request mediation, a written request for non-binding mediation. In fact, the letter from his counsel, which was sent on 2-1 of 16, preceded by much more than 60 days the refiling of the complaint on 12-14-16. Now, the trial court correctly noted a rhetorical distinction between an actual request for non-binding mediation as opposed to an expression of willingness to engage in non-binding mediation. There's a rhetorical difference, but the trial court never explained what is the legal significance of that distinction. And as far as a legal distinction, it's a distinction without a difference, particularly in the context that we're dealing with here of non-binding mediation. The fact that the trial court construed his conduct with respect to this, whether he abided by this provision, so narrowly and said, no, only an actual request as opposed to, hey, sure, let's mediate. It was completely unwarranted. And furthermore, in light of the fact that this was a contract drafted by Serco, to the extent that there was any ambiguity here, why was that ambiguity resolved against, it resolved in favor of the draftsman as opposed to against the draftsman?
May I ask you this? Is one remedy under your perspective, is one remedy that's available to the trial judge dismiss without prejudice?
No.
The dismiss with or without prejudice from your perspective is because of res judicata implications, right? The with prejudice aspect as opposed to without prejudice, your complaint on the with prejudice is because it probably will imply the res judicata bar to a later suit. Is that what you're thinking?
Yes, absolutely.
But without prejudice, it would not have that effect because it wouldn't be on the merits. It wouldn't even purport to be on the merits.
Correct, but the dismissal without prejudice is, that's kind of a misnomer, especially in this case. It's a dismissal with somewhat less prejudice. So there's always the prejudice of having to repay the filing fee, for example. And there are situations, certainly, where a dismissal with without prejudice is appropriate if, for example, the court lacks subject matter jurisdiction. Or there are other, you know, reasons one could come up with where a dismissal without prejudice is appropriate. But the second reason it's inappropriate here is because of the downstream effect. So in this case, although Mr. Prima filed well within the statute of limitations apply to his claims, the trial court's error in dismissing the case. So let's say it should have dismissed it without prejudice. And then within 60 days, he could have, you know, either mediated or not, and then filed. He still would have been well within his statute of limitations. But because the trial court erred and dismissed it with prejudice, and now we have to go through appeals, etc., by the time that error is reversed and it's remanded to the trial court, I mean, his case is effectively barred at that point, because of the passage of time, which wasn't his fault. It was the trial court's error in dismissing it with prejudice.
So it's the statute of limitations implication that keeps you from acknowledging without prejudice as an available option.
Well, that's one reason. I mean, that's certainly a significant reason, but it's not the only reason. The other reason is simply that a dismissal without prejudice, when there is no basis for a dismissal of any kind, is just simply incorrect. And the court doesn't have discretion to simply say, well, I'm going to go ahead and dismiss this case without prejudice.
Well, counsel, except that as I read the contract, and I'm not asking you to concede the point, but a fair reading of the contract is that it requires prior to filing suit that the mediation take place. And so here, it was the inverted sequence where there was a suit first. And so, if my reading of the contract is right, then he put the cart before the horse, and so why wouldn't a dismissal without prejudice to allow the mediation to take place be erroneous?
Well, for several reasons. One is that my reading of the mediation provision is it requires Mr. Prima to have made a written request for mediation. It doesn't necessarily, I mean, I guess one could argue that it requires Serco in good faith to engage in it, but it's not entirely clear. We're talking about non-binding mediation.
Right.
Could Serco have simply said, no, we don't think, you know, it's going to be productive, so we're going to go ahead and pass on that? That it's, you know, in the context of non-binding mediation, it's a little bit more fluid and unclear, but
it's different from arbitration, I'll give you that.
Right. So but even assuming the court were to say, look, this clause could only have meaning if Serco has some reciprocal obligation to engage in good faith in non-binding mediation, and therefore that would have supported a dismissal without prejudice to allow that process to proceed. But that ignores the posture of the case, the posture of the litigant. So the first issue is that with respect to the initial non-suited case, arguably Mr. Primoff did not comply with the mediation provision prior to filing that suit. I mean, And the real reason is we didn't know about it. We didn't know about the existence of that second contract, the letter of assignment. But that's neither here nor there. The fact is it existed. The provision was there. We didn't abide by it prior to the non-suited action. But CERCO did not raise it before the court. So that case proceeded. We took the non-suit. And then with respect to the refiled case, however, the request for mediation or the expression of willingness to engage in mediation preceded the filing of the refiled complaint by more than 60 days. So unless there is a distinction that this court is willing to make, some kind of legal distinction between an expression of willingness to mediate versus a request to mediate, then we need the time frame, because we have a 2-1-16 letter and we have a 12-14-16 refiling date. The fact that it was filed, the non-suited case, has no bearing on any of this, because while the non-suit of the case makes the case evaporate until it's refiled, it certainly doesn't make the correspondence between counsel. It doesn't make it as if that never occurred. And the fact is, on 2-1-16, we sent the letter.
But the timing problems you are explaining as possible contingency issues really are resolved by the one sentence in the letter of assignment. If the dispute has not been resolved by mediation within 60 days, then you can file suit.
And that's true. But then we have some other issues, which are this condition is not a condition preceding. Where is the clear, unmistakable language in that provision that expressly states that it is a condition preceding, or that makes it so unmistakably clear, which this court has consistently set forth that, you know, it's not going to create a condition preceding by implication. I understand that the provision has the word, contains the word shall. And yes, shall can be construed in that mandatory, compulsory fashion. But shall also can be construed in other ways. That alone is sufficient to give that word ambiguity. That alone is sufficient to resolve that ambiguity in favor of Mr. Primoff.
Right, but the second sentence, I'm sorry to interrupt, but the second sentence says, first sentence says, shall attempt in good faith to resolve any dispute through mediation. The second sentence says, if the dispute has not been resolved within 60 days of a written request to mediate, then either party may bring suit. So there's a, by my reading, there's a fairly clear sequence that the contract calls for, and that doesn't mean, I mean, in your favor, it says nothing about any dismissal with prejudice or any of that. But as far as the sequencing, it seems clear enough to me.
Well,
you don't have to concede it.
I understand. But so let's assume that it was a condition preceding. The fact is, this is an indivisible contract. How does that provision survive the termination of the contract? More importantly, in this case, how does that provision survive CERCO's first material breach of the contract? If CERCO was the first to breach this contract, and it's an indivisible contract, then whether it's condition preceding or not a condition preceding, it doesn't matter. It's no longer enforceable.
But that logic, if that were true, would mean none of these clauses would ever be enforceable, because the person suing is mad because there's a breach. And that's why you go into arbitration mediation. That's why that deals go into litigation. So that would just mean that these provisions have no effect.
I disagree. CERCO had the opportunity to draft it in such a way to say that this clause will survive the termination. Like, for example, a non-compete agreement, right? Pretty common, where it says, you know, this survives as an independent covenant. They could have even said, regardless of whether there's a first material breach, this provision, this covenant survives.
But your argument is a breach of contract, the defendant didn't do what you're supposed to do under the contract, and you're going into court suing for it. Well, that's a matter of fact and law for the decision maker. You don't get to make the call. You're bound by the contract you're suing on if you're suing on it.
Right, but CERCO is bound by the contract. They're also bound by their own actions, if they were the first to materially breach, and then they ask that regardless the court enforce that provision, then this court has to then overrule its line of decisions that say that a first material breach prevents the other party from enforcing the contract or from, you know, suing for its breach. Why would that not apply here? I mean, this court, in the context of non-compete provisions, which clearly take effect pretty much after the end of the contract, the employment relationship, but even there, this court has said in its decisions, there was a prior breach by the employer, a prior material breach. If that condition is not independent and does not survive, if the contract is indivisible, so sad, too bad, but it's not enforceable. So that's, you know, unfortunately, the way the contract was drafted did not protect Serco's interest in this non-binding mediation. But again, because we are in the realm of non-binding mediation, the way that this contract language is looked at, I think, was way, way too narrow by the trial court.
All right, now your time has expired.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court, Amy Miller from Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney on behalf of the Appellee Serco Inc. We respectfully disagree that staying the case for 60 days was an option for the trial judge. This exact situation was addressed in the L. White versus Culpepper Memorial case that was cited in our briefs out of the 16th Judicial District, where a failure to comply with the condition precedent of engaging in mediation was before the court. And the plaintiff, at the time of dismissal, asked in the alternative that the case be stayed for 60 days so that the parties could comply with the condition precedent. The judge in that case said that that was not an option because the parties agreed by contract that the mediation must occur before the litigation starts, and to do otherwise would essentially rewrite the agreement. And that is what we have here, a clear condition precedent which requires that the mediation or the demand for mediation occur before the litigation starts.
Let me ask you this. Why, though, did the trial court issue a dismissal with prejudice result? With prejudice connotes res judicata effect, which only applies when the merits of the prior proceeding has been addressed. But obviously the merits in this case have not been addressed.
So dismissal with prejudice was appropriate for several reasons. First of all, as to the merits, this court has had the opportunity to address cases where a case was dismissed on a plea and bar. And it's important to remember that this case was dismissed on a plea and bar and not on a demur. It was an evidentiary hearing. And in both Gilbreth versus Brewster and in Hughes versus Jane Doe, this court has held on past instances that a plea and bar is appropriate, dismissal in a plea and bar is appropriate dismissal with prejudice, even if the merits have not been adjudicated.
Well, sure, but so take, you know, statute of limitations defenses, for instance. Well, that's different, because here it's just go before a mediator, see if you can meet in the middle, figure out a compromise solution or who's right and wrong, and look, if it doesn't get resolved through mediation, then expressly under the contract, you can go off to court and seek your day in court. So here, maybe put the cart before the horse, but to just completely, pull the plug on any claim seems like a very harsh outcome, particularly when the contract doesn't say, and if you get it wrong and you go to the court first instead of mediator first, I mean, it just doesn't address that. It doesn't say that here's the consequence for your failure. It just seems like a very harsh outcome for not going to non-binding mediation first. And that's my rub with this case.
So respectfully, we would say that it was not a harsh result for several reasons, and dismissal with prejudice was appropriate. Number one, this plaintiff never once requested leave to amend. In the second lawsuit that was filed, it was litigated for over 8 months, including discovery. There was an evidentiary plea and bar hearing. There were four briefs, at a minimum, filed by the plaintiff, including extensive briefs in excess of 20 pages on motion and reply and a hearing, and the plaintiff did not request leave for amend. And that was considered.
Why would that not, if that's a breach of contract, you should have gone to mediation first, you went to court first. And now you made us generate all these costs responding to your breach of contract. Why isn't the answer to seek damages for those costs rather than just dismiss the lawsuit outright?
Because it's important to remember the purpose of the condition precedent. The purpose of the dispute resolution process is twofold. Number one, to resolve the disputes confidentially and a confidential mediation. And once you file a public lawsuit, that purpose has been completely eviscerated. And number two, as you just pointed out, it is also to save costs, the litigation expenses. And in this case, the litigation had gone on collectively for almost 3 years, and the plaintiff steadfastly refused to engage in mediation. I'd like to address it.
But am I right that you didn't file a motion to dismiss in the original action when it was pending, right?
So in the original action, and this was handled by another law firm, but in the original action, the complaint was filed without the letter of assignment attached. It only attached the offer letter, and so the condition precedent was missing. And the former law firm filed a demur as to the allegations in the complaint and what was attached to the complaint. In discovery, the letter of assignment, which was a part of the contract, was produced. And then at that point, Serco asked the plaintiff to non-suit the case for failure to comply with the condition precedent. So there was no waiver of that condition precedent in the first suit. And in any event, that first suit was non-suited. The second suit, it was raised from the outset, and it was attached to the complaint. Therefore, the basis for both the demur and the plea and bar was failure to comply with the condition precedent. In addition to
that, and I think too, if you had arbitration, all the the arguments about costs and confidentiality and so on, that's a binding proceeding. But suppose the parties just cannot get along, so we go through the mediation, and it just doesn't work out at all. So then all these, the claims of prejudice of, well, we had to litigate, we had to go through discovery, we had to do legal research, and then it was a public proceeding versus confidentiality mediation. Well, if the mediation never works out, all that's true at the back end. So why is the appropriate sanction dismissal with prejudice when, for all we know, we might have been exactly where we were here just a little bit later having gone through the mediation?
I think this situation is very similar to the situation in the Gilbreth versus Brewster case heard by this court back in 1995, where the plaintiff failed to effect service under Rule 3.3 after the complaint was filed and non-suited, and then tried to file another complaint and then serve that complaint. And this court held that to allow the plaintiff repeated filings in circumventing would effectively circumvent that the purpose of 3.3, which is to timely serve. This case is very similar in that the plaintiff not once but twice filed a suit without filing or submitting a written demand for mediation. And I think that the communications that he made in his refusal to do so are very telling. During the first lawsuit, when it was brought to his attention that there was a mandatory mediation clause and he should non-suit the case, his response was, quote, "I would not be opposed to pursuing mediation concurrently with the court proceedings, so long as we don't have to incur any expense." Again, that circumvents the provision which requires it to be before the lawsuit. The second thing that he said, and this is at Appendix 36, the pendency of this lawsuit may impel the parties towards settlement. Again, that completely eviscerates the purpose of the resolution clause, which is to resolve them privately and not to try to leverage a public lawsuit for a private settlement. The third thing he said, and I quote, "Serco should consider the bad publicity that likely will result should this lawsuit proceed." Again, trying to leverage the public filing of the lawsuit for something that she should have done on the first end. And all of these communications.
You talk about the prejudice to your client because they did not demand mediation. The clause allows either party to demand mediation. So if you wanted to avoid the damage of going forward with this without mediation taking place in the first instance, why didn't you demand it from your perspective? You have the right to do it. The clause allows either party to demand mediation.
But he had already filed a lawsuit, respectfully. And I would also like to quote the plaintiff on this when we'd like to clarify that he was never invited to mediation. The condition precedent was brought to his attention, and for that reason, he was requested to non-suit the case. But he responded, "We cannot," and I quote, "we cannot honor your request that we abandon the pending legal proceedings we initiated, as that train has already left the station." And that's Appendix 36. And that is exactly our point. You can't take it back. You've already filed a public lawsuit. And so it really doesn't do Serco any good to go back and try to do to comply with his condition precedent for him. He was supposed to do that before he filed the suit. He failed to do it the first time. And there is an argument that maybe he could have saved it before the second suit. But the second suit, filed 2 years later, he still didn't demand mediation. And even
neither did you.
Absolutely not. We never...
You never demanded mediation?
We never demanded mediation. We never invited him to mediation. We only asked him, for lack of a better phrase, for show cause to show why he should not suit the case for failure to doing it in the first instance.
May I ask you this? I'm not particularly familiar with this federal contracting industry, but you know, some industries are very sensitive to their public image, and so, you know, if there's a lawsuit that they're discriminating on some basis or another, it's a big black eye for them and in their public relations and so on. How much, I mean, I understand nobody wants to be dragged into court, but how much of a problem is this to have this public lawsuit versus a confidential mediation in this industry?
Serco is a government contractor, and it is very important to try to resolve their employees with disputes with their employees before the litigation is filed in court. These condition precedents are very common. They're in almost all of the contracts for these types of employees who go overseas. Obviously, what they're doing is of the highest security clearance, and types of activities that they're doing are also highly confidential.
Right.
So, in addition, I think we are not saying that the court needs to say that dismissal with prejudice was required. Our argument is that it was within the trial court's discretion to dismiss the case with prejudice in this instance. And in this instance, there were several facts that supported that. Again, he never asked for leave to amend. It was not in the early stages of litigation. The case had gone on for 8 months in the second suit. He was expressly made aware of the provision in the first suit, and he still failed to make the demand.
Which he should have been aware of in the first instance anyway.
That is correct. He should have been aware in the first instance because it was in the contract. That's exactly right. And there was also precedent. There was clear authority for the court to make a dismissal with prejudice finding, which should be given deference to this court. There was the L. White case versus Culpeper Memorial. That case was dismissed with prejudice out of the 16th Judicial District. It was very similar to this case in terms of how the condition precedent was worded and how the court handled the case. And it was in that same case that the plaintiff asked for a stay for 60 days to mediate the case, and the court said no. The parties agreed it would happen before, and to do otherwise would essentially rewrite the agreement. And then finally, I would say there is authority as well with this court's decisions in Gilbreth and Hughes versus Jane Doe, in that this was on a plea and bar. This was not a demur dismissal. It was a plea and bar after extensive discovery, extensive briefing, an evidentiary hearing. And this court has held that even if the substantive issue has not been adjudicated, it is there are cases in which a plea and bar dismissal can be conclusive as to the party's rights.
Does Gilbreth really help you when you think about it? Because in the Gilbreth case, the court found that a dismissal had to be with prejudice because of the language of Rule 3:3.
and to dismiss it without prejudice would eviscerate the rule.
Whereas in your particular instance, the reason for the dismissal would be the language in the contract. And that doesn't seem to contemplate a dismissal of the case. In other words, it just seems to require that the demand be made before the lawsuit is brought.
From our review of the Supreme Court's authority, this court has looked at least three instances in which a dismissal with prejudice would be appropriate for a plea and bar where there is a procedural issue. One is the service of process under 3.3. The second is statute of limitations. The third is sovereign immunity, which is mentioned in dicta in the Gilbert opinion. Justice Kinzer's dissent in the Hughes v. Doe case
Can I stop you there for a second? In all three of those instances, the basis for the special plea was something that was immutable. You know, if something has violated the statute of limitations, giving somebody leave to amend is not going to help at all. Same thing if there's sovereign immunity. Giving them leave to amend is not going to help at all. So it seems like to me those cases differ from yours because of that.
So we are not arguing that because it was a plea and bar, it was required to be dismissal. We're simply saying that there is precedent for dismissal with prejudice on a plea and bar. And yes, that's correct, but as Justice Kinzer explained in her dissent, in those situations, a dismissal of a claim because of an affirmative defense, like sovereign immunity and so forth, precludes a plaintiff from ever prosecuting that claim. In this particular case, the plaintiff failed to comply, and by filing the lawsuit, it does make it almost impossible for him to take it back, because the purposes of the condition precedent and keeping the dispute confidential and conserving costs are completely undermined. And he can effectively continue to harass the defendant by continuing to file these cases if they are just dismissed with prejudice if he doesn't comply with the condition precedent.
Has she answered your question?
She has. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Your time has expired. Call the next case.